Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As college and high school seniors prepare to launch into the world, commencement speakers offer words of wisdom for a new generation of thinkers, innovators, and leaders. Steve Jarding recently gave the commencement speech at Dakota Wesleyan University in Mitchell, the city of his birth. Jarding has taught at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University since 2004. He's been working in local and national politics for more than four decades, and he joins us now on the phone from Mitchell. Steve Jarding, welcome. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be on, Lori. Appreciate it.
All right. This is something of a homecoming for you. Tell us a little bit about your connection to Dakota Wesleyan to start out with, please.
Well, at least part of my early life in Mitchell. Our family actually had a farm outside of Mitchell by Alexandria, South Dakota. But my dad died when I was 4 months old, and we stayed on the farm for a while. I was the youngest of eight kids, and kind of roundabout way, my mom ran a hotel in Ethan, South Dakota, and tried to make that work, and then moved to Mitchell. She was the first woman in her family who went to college, and she ended up working as a business secretary at Mitchell and got the job there. So we moved there, and I graduated from high school in 76, and met my wife there and fell in love, and we got married, and then went to college. And after college, we came back, and actually I was at Dakota Wesleyan for a year as public relations director in 1981 before I left and went back to graduate school. But so we had that connection. I was a paper boy in Mitchell and happened to be George McGovern's paper boy. And of course, he has a huge connection to Dakota Wesleyan, and McGovern and I got to be good friends before his death. And so there was that. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's you grow up in Mitchell in the 60s and 70s, and it's a small town by most standards, a decent sized town in South Dakota, but it was idyllic in many ways. And so the thought that I could go back to Dakota Wesleyan and give an address to, you know, this next generation of graduates and leaders was a real treat, and I was honored to do so.
Tell us, when you first sat down to think about what message you wanted to bring to them, how did you approach that task?
Well, in many ways, Lori, it's easy because I give an address. I've been fortunate, as you said, I've been at Harvard for 16 years. I teach a public speaking course and a leadership course, and I also teach around the world, teach every year in Brazil and in Romania, and I've been, I think, in close to 40 countries now doing teaching. And very often the theme is similar to what I gave at Dakota Wesleyan on Sunday, and that is that the world is a very rapidly changing place. It's changing so rapidly, it's hard to envision. It's hard to look at what modern medicine is going to do to extend the lives of human beings. It's hard to project how fast automation is supplanting human beings when it comes to our jobs. It's hard to fathom the effects of global warming, including, today we have 69 million refugees in the world. It's projected, was on a panel in Greece a couple of years ago, my wife and I, and they were projecting, all the experts said, it's 65 million today, but it's going to be 1.2 billion in 30 years. You almost can't get your arms around statistics like that. So part of the message is the world is changing quicker than we've ever seen. We have problems that are much more global today than they ever were. Former problems for much of a, 17, 18, 19th century, 20th century were regional, ideological, geographic. But today they're global. And the difference, the second part of the message that I give and did yesterday at Dakota Wesleyan was, but you're the smartest generation and the best equipped generation in world history to deal with these problems. You are, again, just when it comes to intelligence, you've got more intelligence. When it comes to knowledge, we are just a few years away from literally doubling all human knowledge every 12 hours. This is the most wired generation in human history. They have the first universal language in human history. It's not a mother tongue, it's technology, but they're all wired through the same mobile devices and social media platforms, literally everywhere in the world where I and my wife have traveled. And that's, we've not had that before. So yeah, the problems are bigger, they're global, they're more difficult, but we also, you can't tell me the solution to global warming isn't in all that knowledge. We've got to go find it. or the solution to pretty much any of human problems isn't in that knowledge. There was a time, Lori, when, you know, if 30 years ago you and I went into the doctor and said, you know, I got a bad heart, or you went into the hospital because you had a heart attack, the doctor may say that we just don't know how to fix it. You know, so we can try open heart surgery, but it doesn't necessarily succeed all the time because we just don't know how. Today, we just don't know how is not a refrain you're going to hear very much. We know how to do a whole lot today. And so that's the message that young people, you have to understand that you have capability, and you have to understand, although it's a daunting responsibility, it is your responsibility, because the world is knocking at your door and saying, we need a little help.
So let's talk about how that can be daunting. And just today, another, a news story, a study released about a million species facing extinction.
Yes.
You mentioned a number like 1.2 billion refugees in 30 years.
Yes.
How do people who are coming into the world, who are launching from a college, from high school, you know, seeking higher education, how do they not just become overwhelmed by or numb to some of those statistics? Because it can seem insurmountable.
Well, it can. I mean, it is daunting in that sense. And but I think, again, this is the boldest generation I've ever seen. I mean, I've been in, you know, teaching for over 30 years. I've been in, you know, kind of working in the public sector and politics for over 40 years. We've never had the capability that we have today. I think it's more a matter of universities have to start teaching differently. They have to prepare students differently to let them understand that these are real problems. We have to defy the forces of greed that try to deny global warming. Is an easy example. When oil companies, and I get oil companies, they're sitting on $27 trillion of resources left on planet Earth, the fossil fuel resources. You know, if I'm an oil company, my shareholders say, go get it. The problem is, if they go get it and burn it, for every 565 gigatons, and there's the 2,700 gigatons of carbon left in planet Earth, the temperature rises 2 degrees. I think we have to educate students to that. We have to defy the fake news, the forces of greed. And we got to be honest with ourselves. What kind of planet do we want? What kind of planet do we want to leave to our kids and grandkids? Because the difference today is, Lori, it's happening so fast.
Right.
I mean, I tell the story in the first Earth Day, you know, which I was 50 years ago or whatever. I my friend Jimmy Hilton and I went in an alley to honor Earth Day and picked up tin cans. And 50 years ago, no one was talking about global warming. No one was saying the planet is in deep trouble. No one was saying, that if we hit 4 degrees Celsius, and we will hit 4 degrees Celsius in the track that we're headed, rise in temperature, that the oceans will rise 150 to 260 feet. We didn't know that in 1969 or 79 or 89. Well, we know it today. And when you have 80% of the human population living within 80 miles of an ocean, my God, I mean, when that water rises, all that infrastructure, all that valuable property, it's going to be worthless. We can't afford to rebuild that. We got to figure out how to stop this. And so, yes, it could be overwhelming, but I have to have faith in the power of the human mind and the human spirit to say, we'll deal with it. And it's critical, though, the point that there was an absolute point not too many years ago, if we'd have had these same problems and we were having this conversation, Lori, I'd say, yeah, no, the problems are unbelievably significant and severe, but we don't know how to solve them. We don't have the technology. We don't have the knowledge. That's not true today. Hmm. We have the knowledge. We have the technology. We've got to change our paradigm of how we think about these problems in governance, and we've got to figure out how to go after them. And that is the charge to the next generation. My speech yesterday was called Creating Giants. And the idea is these guys are the giants. My job as a professor and lecturer and somebody that's been around the world a bunch and saw what's going on is to give them perspective, is to inspire them, is to mold them and let them know it's okay to serve. And in fact, it's unbelievably important that you do serve, because this is the generation that's going to have to solve this stuff. I firmly believe that. If we don't solve these major crises on planet Earth in the next 15 to 20 years, I fear for planet Earth.
Does your optimism come from your students? In some ways, you teach, you know, one of it's been voted the most influential course at Harvard. It's a
right.
class that people are just, going to great lengths and trying to figure out how to get into about campaign management
right.
and leadership. When you listen to those students, because I'm sure, you don't just stand and lecture, but there's a reason
right.
they're all trying to get into that class and you have that back and forth. What are you hearing from them? What are you hearing from those really bright students about what they are trying to accomplish and how they're going to accomplish some of these things?
Well, it's a great question because it is the answer. The answer is you could be really depressed today. You go around the world and you see governments that are corrupt and you see, governmental policy that is destroying the environment or that's creating income inequality and not providing health care and not feeding people and, all this stuff. It's depressing. The world's in a tough shape. But you sit in the classroom and you listen to these students. And I'm at Kennedy. The Kennedy School is a graduate school at Harvard. So my students are graduate students, and about half of them come from around the world. I teach about 300 students a year, and they're exactly. It's why it's a great question. They are the hope. If I didn't have that, you could walk away. When you go into Brendan and I have been to Indonesia. We've been to just from Bangladesh to Mongolia to Ukraine to all over Europe. There's issues out there. There are real problems. And if you just saw that, it would be easy to not be optimistic. But the plus for us is when we go around the world, we get, we go to interact with the best and the brightest students. We go to interact with this next generation. And invariably, without exception, you walk away from those meetings. I mean, we went to Kenya, Africa, and in Nairobi and met with students. And, there's not a lot of wealth there. There's all kinds of issues. But when we left Kenya, we kind of said, we'll be okay. We've got to convince these young people to get involved,
right.
that they've got a responsibility in public service. But no, it is the students that give the inspiration, and that's the answer to the question. How do you stay optimistic? Because the next yeah. generation is so talented and I think is inspired.
Let's talk a little bit about involvement because, and let's go back a few years because you got your start in politics in the 1980s? You're executive director of the South Dakota
yeah.
Democratic Party. You've worked for
right.
With Tom Daschle and Tim Johnson.
Yep.
And how has politics changed? That's a huge question, but when you hear a question like that, what is the first thing that sort of comes to your mind in sort of how politics has changed that really students coming up in the world need to understand?
Well, the easy answer is money. I am not a fan, frankly, of political parties in America. You have to pick one, and when you pick one, that's your party. I'm not saying I'm not, proud of having worked with people, as you indicate, like Tom Daschle or Tim Johnson or Mark Warner or Jim Webb or Bob Kerry or any of the people I've worked for over the years, really good people. But when you look at the money in politics, it's staggering. Think of it this way. In 2001, so almost 20 years ago, we had 16,000 lobbyists registered in Washington, D.C. They were spending about $25 million a month to lobby Congress. Today, we have 46,000, not 16,000, 46,000 lobbyists registered in Washington. And they're not spending $25 million a month. They're spending $600 million a month to lobby Congress. That's a fundamentally broken system. We have the Citizens United court case that came down on January 21st, 1969, that allowed for the first time ever foreign money in U.S. elections, and foreign money is coming into U.S. elections. It allowed corporations to be able to spend unlimited amounts of money. You and I are capped if we want to give to a federal candidate in the United States. You and I are capped as individuals at $2,700. Corporation could write a $1 billion check if they wanted. And corporations are writing, and individuals who are wealthy, extremely wealthy, are filling up the coffers of these super PACs, and it's broken the American system. America's democracy is absolutely in trouble because of the money. We have to figure out a way to get money out of it. We have to figure out a way to get more people involved. And if we don't, I fear for America's representative democracy. I mean, think of this number, Lori. Last year, the United States Senate was in session 95 days. Now, last I looked, and you know, to be somewhat cynical here, there's 365 days in the calendar. Working 95 days isn't exactly pushing the envelope. And if you look at the Senator Fritz Hollings from South Carolina, who just died a few weeks ago, Fritz Hollings served, I think it was six terms in the Senate. He left the Senate 12 years ago. And when he left the Senate, Lori, he wrote an op-ed piece for the Washington Post. And he said, basically, here's why I'm retiring. He said, when I was first elected to the Senate, I got elected in South Carolina. And so you get elected, you go to Washington. And so we'd fly to Washington Sunday night. We'd gavel in Monday morning, go to subcommittee hearings and then hearings and then do floor work. And late afternoon, you'd do constituent work. And then Friday night, they would gavel out. You'd fly back to South Carolina and meet with constituents. And he said, I did that for 5 years. And then in the sixth year, when, you know, my term was up in 6 years, I'd start raising money. But I raised all my money in South Carolina and got reelected. That process repeated itself. He said, fast forward to today. And again, this was 12 years ago. It's much worse today. He said, today, and this is still true, Lori, the U.S. Senate gavels in Monday afternoon, which means they don't work at all on Monday. They gavel out Thursday afternoon, so they don't work Fridays. And he said, the problem is we don't go to subcommittee hearings anymore at all. And that's where senators and congresspeople used to learn, you know, both witnesses from both sides would come and testify. And that's how they educated these guys. Well, they don't hardly go to committee hearings. They will go to vote, but very often all these members of Congress have beepers on their belts or in their pockets, and they're in their campaign office raising money, and the beeper goes off, and they you know, drive over to the building where the hearing is. And they walk in and they say to the aide, how do I vote? And the aide says, you're voting nay on this one or yay on this one, Senator. And they vote. They don't even know what they voted on. They turn around and walk out. And Fritz Hollings said, but the difference was I still didn't go home to South Carolina on weekends anymore. I went to New York and Dallas and Miami and Los Angeles. And every weekend I raised money. And I didn't do that just the sixth year of my term. I did it the week after I got elected. So for 6 years, and Fritz Hollings had this stunning statistic. He said, the main reason I'm leaving 12 years ago in Little South Carolina, he said, to raise enough money to get reelected in South Carolina in early 2000s, he said, I have to raise $30,000 a week, every week for 6 years to have enough money. And he said, that system's broken. So I know that's a long answer, but it's an important one. If we don't get our arms around money, I think our democracy is in serious, serious jeopardy.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Steve Jarding. He recently gave the commencement speech at Dakota Wesleyan. He's an international political consultant and author, and he's a lecturer at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. He's been there for 16 years. And Steve, give us a path forward then. You know, where do you begin to get, because it seems like you have candidates who run on getting on this topic, on getting money out of politics. Those candidates don't always do very well.
Well, they don't, and it's a dichotomy. The number one kind of concern, or the number one question I get, where I have that I think it's almost there's no good answer, is when people say, "Well, if you want to get money out of politics, how can you advise candidates to run and take money that you know is greedy or is right. you know if you by your own admission it doesn't?" And I say, "Yeah, I can't reconcile that." You've got to win. You have to have title to affect change. And I tell students all the time, you know, if the rules say take it, I might say take it because it's too important to say I can't. I have to have title. So if I have to play by the rules and the rules are skewed, get title and then go change the rules. And it's the one part of my kind of the entire litany of what I teach that I don't like. But it's the reality. And I tell people, you know, don't break the law. I tell my students and, you know, and most laws and campaign laws around the country, including the United States, are pretty lax. So you're not necessarily going to break it. But I mean, I did a race, Lori, in Indonesia, where the president's race in Indonesia. And when I met with the candidate for the first time, when we were just kind of talking about his campaign, and I said, you know, let's see, you know, Indonesia is a nation of 267 million people. So it's a pretty big country. It's almost the size of the United States. I said, how much money do you have to raise as a presidential candidate in Indonesia? He said about 250 million U.S. dollars. I said, wow, 250. Okay. I said, how do you raise that? He said, I got a guy. And I said, what do you mean you got a guy? He said, I got a guy. And I said, okay, so you got one guy that's going to give you $250 million. And he said, that's right.
Wow.
And I said, my God, is that legal? He said, yeah, everybody does. And I looked at him and I said, well, you realize that guy is going to want a whole lot for that $250 million.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he said, yeah. He said, I'm not going to give it to him. But without his $250 million, I can't get elected. And so I'm going to get title, and then I'm going to tell him, you ain't getting what you want. You're fine. You're a billionaire. You're going to get enough because you're smart at what you do. But just because you think you bought me, you didn't. And it was pretty telling because it's a pretty smart politician. It seems right. There's an ethical issue here. There's a, you know, kind of a, you know, a shell game going on with this candidate and the funder. But that's what you see worldwide. And, you know, so this idea again that we're seeing this worldwide problem. We have to get our arms around that. We have to get elected. You have to have title. I tell my students all the time, you cannot affect change unless you have title. So, and I look at political parties as merely a vehicle to cross a finish line. Get mm-hmm. yourself title, and then you can do good. But so if I have to play by the rules, because I've had a lot of candidates, Lori, that'll say, well, I don't like big money in politics, so I'm going to only take $250 a person. And I'll say to them, well, what's your opponent taking? Well, $2,700 a person, plus they have a super PAC. And I'll say, well, you can't win. I mean, 90% of races in the world, Glory, that have the most money win. If you only knew that, you'd say, well, then I got to play by the money rule. I may not like it, but I got to play it until I get title, and then hopefully I can change it.
So let's talk about, because you mentioned political parties, and how are those parties changing? Because it seems as if not only from a financial backing standpoint, the game has changed, but also what lawmakers are willing to say about, you know, there's a high risk of coming out and saying something that does not toe a party line. Talk a little bit, you know, through social media and just how quick the response can be if a Republican or a Democrat says something against the leaders of their party, whether it be Nancy Pelosi or Donald Trump or just, you know, a concept. It can be suicide, political suicide. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, it certainly can. And again, it's one of the dangers. One of the reasons that people are afraid when Donald Trump says, if you don't toe the line, I'll get rid of you. Or if Nancy Pelosi, you know, says to one of the new members of Congress, it says, I want a much broader social program. Well, you can't do that. Is that they've got the political leverage to hurt them. The party leaders control donors. Party leaders have megaphones. Party leaders control an infrastructure that says you can hurt people, that you could affect their reelection. We certainly saw a lot of people that challenged Donald Trump that went on to defeat, have even in a primary, and Donald Trump would go campaign against their opponents and be successful. That's part of the danger, but it's also, it comes back to money. If we had campaigns in America that were publicly funded, and I've never understood why we don't, and people say, well, I don't want to spend taxpayer monies to fund elections, as opposed to what? Greedy people internationally, billionaires buying politicians, so they get, you know, they get all the best tax policy, they get all the breaks, and you're the one picking up the tab. I'd rather have the people own our elections by each of them, essentially giving some tax dollars through public financing. But you have to change it. If we had that change, and Donald Trump or Nancy Pelosi, if I'm a member of Congress and I'm a Republican and Donald Trump said, well, Jarding, I don't like the fact that you challenged me. I can say, so what?
Yeah.
I don't fear you. I've got my own source of financing, and financing is what runs campaigns. We can deny it. Yes, it's about issues. Yes, it's about policy and ideology and other things. But if you don't have the money in politics, again, 90% of people around the world and in the U.S., it's even higher. It's in the mid-90s. If you've got more money in American politics, you tend to win almost exclusively. There are certainly exceptions, but almost exclusively.
So what do you recommend for candidates in using their voice when there's, you know, a tweet comes out and, you know, people, you know, snap their heads to say, well, what does my congressman have to say about this? What is your advice? Because, you know, it could be a way to pinch off the dollars if they say the wrong thing at that moment. How do you advise candidates in that regard?
Well, it definitely did. And this will sound horrible, Lori, in one way, but I would encourage candidates to always keep an eye on title, that you can't govern if you can't get elected. So if you have to, I tell candidates I would never lie. I don't believe in that. I think it's wrong. I think it's fundamentally dangerous to our representative system. But that doesn't mean that I have to talk about every issue that could be problematic. It doesn't mean that I don't control my own message to the point that if someone said, well, what about this, I can say, I don't think that's the issue that the American people care about. Or somebody says, well, what's your yes or no answer? Well, sometimes in life there's not a yes or no answer, and that's not the issue anyway. The issue, and go back to your message. I've counseled dozens of candidates over the years not to get pigeonholed, not to let someone lead you, not to let someone define you, define yourself, define your agenda. Make it about the people. Make it about service. That's what voters want, not just in America, but around the world. It's hard sometimes for candidates to be disciplined.
Yeah. Does that make people sound a little slippery, though, when journalists are trying to, you know, press them into answering a question and, you know, they're off on talking points, you know, about some other issue?
Yeah. No, I get it. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I was a journalism major in undergrad.
Right. Yeah, that's why I'm asking. Yeah.
I love journalism. I think, if anything, you talk about what's the problem in politics. Money's the first one. The second one is we've undermined our own press corps. I mean, we've got politicians, saying the press corps is akin to, you know, something that Joseph Stalin said. That is offensive as could be to me. I mean, this is America. I grew up at a time when people called the press the fourth estate of government, that they believed it was so important. Jefferson talked about, if we don't have a free press, this nation will never stand. If we don't have a press that is unfettered, it won't stand. But there's a fine line between, and I think in this era of journalism, where, you know, social media is bleeding in, our social media folks, you know, bloggers, somebody with a Twitter feed, are they really journalists? Well, the answer is no, not really, although they have a platform like journalists do. They move messages like journalists do. They tend to have audiences like journalists do. And so you have to play in that era where, you know, you can't let, as I said a minute ago, you can't let somebody dictate what your message is. I can establish myself and who I am and what my beliefs are and the major issues of the day, so that journalists, and I believe this can happen. I have a lot of friends and journalists in America and around the world. I believe they do a terrific job, even with politicians who try not to answer questions, you know, right. And that does happen. But, and I think it's okay. I'm fine with journalists pushing, but I would too. But as someone who works for political figures, I want them to be cautious, because, again, as kind of weird as it sounds, it's all about gaining title. You have to get elected. Again, I never would tell somebody to lie to you. I never would tell them to break the law. But be smart. Establish your message. Hopefully it's a good one that connects with the people in areas that impact their lives, because I tell all my candidates and people I work for that, you know, service is not about those who serve. It's about those who would be served. You can never forget that. So how are you going to take care of those people that would be served? If your message is, you know, kind of under the umbrella of that mantra, I think you'll be fine. And then be careful. If Lori says, Steve, what about this? And it's not an area that I think, indeed is something that is the greatest impact to the people. And you may ask it because it's timely. Because, I mean, I'll give you an example. The Pete Buttigieg deal just was over the weekend, where Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, is running for president. A blog gets a young 21-year-old kid to they talk to him about, would you go on record saying Pete Buttigieg sexually assaulted you. Well, Pete Buttigieg did not sexually assault his kid. And they talked to him, and the kid, you know, said, people followed the story, but the kid left the room. There were two people trying to convince him he should do this fake blog post. And he said, I don't feel comfortable, and he left to sleep on it. And the next morning, wakes up, and the blog post is out saying he assaulted. Now, as a journalist, you're probably saying, I got to ask that question, okay? That doesn't mean that Pete Buttigieg has to answer it a certain way. I mean, if he answered, in this case, it's, you know, he said, well, it's not true, and when you run for president, bad things happen. But the point is, sometimes the story in the news is something you don't want to talk about. Donald Trump is a master at sending out Twitter feeds every morning telling people this is what the news of the world is. And then journalists, because he's president of the United States, for God's sake, feel they have to talk about it. I get that. I'm just saying politicians and people who run for office have to be disciplined enough to say there's a lot of clutter out there. And you got to figure out what do the people need. And if you stay to that message, you're probably going to serve yourself pretty well.
All right. Cutting through the clutter with Steve Darting. He is a lecturer at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, originally from South Dakota. Mitchell, graduate of USD. And thank you so much for being here with us, Steve. Welcome home. We appreciate your time.
Well, it's great to be with you. It is great to be home. But I love listening to you guys, and keep up your good work.